Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated July 1st, 2011. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, top of the fold, the first article reads, Texans May Ride In With More Apartments, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. A Texas company that has been assembling land near Briar Creek for more than a decade has begun planning for a massive 124-acre mixed-use development at the intersection of U.S. 70 and T.W. Alexander Drive. Michael Tonti, president of Dallas, Texas-based Tonti Properties, has signed off on two rezoning applications filed with the Raleigh Planning Department in June that would increase the residential density for one parcel and eliminate a split zoning designation for another. The project, tentatively called The Corners, would encompass a mix of apartment units, retail shops, and restaurants, as well as some office space based on the current and proposed zoning regulations for the property. Tonti has not yet filed a site plan detailing specific ideas for the property. The site plan, when filed, will better detail how many buildings could be built at the site and how many residential units are planned. Tommy Craven, a principal with the Priest Craven and Associates engineering firm in Raleigh, is working with Tonti on the project, but Craven referred questions to the company. A representative of Tonti Properties did not return calls for comment. The rezoning requests are scheduled for a public hearing before the city's zoning board on October 18th. Tonti Properties owns and manages about 20 apartment communities in Texas, Louisiana, Arizona, Maryland, Colorado, and Mississippi, but it currently has no income assets in North Carolina. Tonti's Creekwood Real Estate Services subsidiary purchased its first 29 acres of land in Wake County in 2000 and has since assembled a total of 124 acres on both sides of the Wake County-Durham County line at a total of more than $6.77 million, according to county deed records. The property is expected to be annexed into Durham per a Raleigh-Durham annexation agreement that was approved several years ago. Apartment developers, particularly in West Raleigh, have been coming out of the woodwork in recent months as demand for new apartment construction escalates. Epoch Properties of Winter Park, Florida, started construction in late May on a 276-unit apartment complex called the Jameson at Briar Creek. At least two other development groups have bought land near Briar Creek for apartments. Davis Development of Stockbridge, Georgia, purchased 21 acres near the intersection of Interstate 540 and Aviation Parkway in December with plans to build a 236-unit apartment complex. The Residential Group of Atlanta bought 15 acres near U.S. 70 and ACC Boulevard for a 291-unit project called Crest at Briar Creek. American Asset Corporation of Charlotte, one of the original Briar Creek development companies, has filed a new master plan for its Briar Creek Town Center project on Arco Corporate Drive, that would add 600 apartment units. The Briar Creek Town Center project proposes construction of four 10-story buildings and two 8-story buildings that would add about 1.5 million square feet of office space and another 100,000 square feet of retail shop space to Briar Creek, says Joe Dye, executive vice president of American Asset Corporation, in charge of its Raleigh office. Quote, apartments are in demand and a preferred asset class in today's environment, Dye says, but this will be a long-term development for us that will be market-driven, end quote. This week's lead article, on the front page, Red Hat, Get Off My Cloud, by Monica Chin, from Raleigh. As Red Hat heads into the clouds, it is leveraging existing open-source advantages, rolling out new products and taking aim at competitors, such as Microsoft, in jockeying to become the tech company to define the cloud and virtualization space. CEO Jim Whitehurst is touting the pace of the growth in the cloud space, much of it in China, as a major component of Red Hat's growth. He and other company executives are not being shy in taking on Microsoft and VMware, a California-based deliverer of proprietary virtualization software. Whitehurst projects Red Hat will blow by $1 billion in revenues in 2011, according to a published report, and has set a target of $3 billion in annual revenue within 5 years. That's well within reach of the homegrown Raleigh company based on its revenue trajectory over the past decade, a period in which Red Hat's quarterly revenue increased from $25 million in the first quarter of 2003 to $265 million in the first quarter of fiscal 2012. Contrary to Whitehurst's emphasis on China, he made the comments while on a business trip to the nation. The Americas and European markets have grown faster for Red Hat than the Asia-Pacific region. From fiscal years 2006 to 2011, Asia-Pacific revenue nearly tripled from $42.4 million to $125.8 million. At the same time, revenue in the EMEA market, that's Europe, Middle East, and Africa, more than quadrupled from $48.7 million to $199.6 million. And revenue in the Americas more than tripled from $187.2 million to $583.8 million. To continue to grow those numbers, Red Hat is looking to the cloud. The company is rolling out new cloud products this year, including OpenShift, a platform as a service software for developers who build on open source. Another is Red Hat CloudForms, a product for creating and managing infrastructure as a service on private and hybrid public-private clouds. OpenShift enables the remote use of JBoss, Red Hat's successful middleware software. Steve Ashley, an analyst with Robert W. Baird & Company, a Milwaukee-based financial services firm, says Red Hat already has an advantage in its push for the cloud because of its open-source enterprise software, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, or RHEL. The RHEL operating system is already used in 9 of the 10 largest public cloud architectures, the exception being competitor Microsoft. Quote, clearly, one of the foundational components in the most large cloud architectures is RHEL operating system, Ashley says. Continuing the quote, Red Hat is an industrial-strength operating system. Microsoft Windows tends to be used for lighter-weight applications, but for things that are larger and more important, like Amazon's website or Goldman Sachs' trading desk, those would run on Red Hat's industrial-strength operating system, end quote. The next step in Red Hat's cloud strategy, according to Ashley, would be to push for the adoption of JBoss, the company's middleware product that connects the heavy infrastructure products with lighter software applications. Ashley's quoted again as saying, one of the important goals is to get JBoss used at another layer of the app server. That is a layer in the cloud that is not dominated by anyone, and it is an area that Red Hat, through OpenShift, can get JBoss broadly used, end quote. In that regard, Red Hat sees VMware as a barrier to the company's dominance of the cloud space, and that's why executives are speaking out against the proprietary virtualization provider. VMware and various startups are the ones that we see ourselves going head-to-head in the customer base with right now, Paul Conyer says, and he's president of Products and Technologies and executive vice president of engineering with Red Hat. And he made this comment during the company's first quarter earnings call. The cloud space, because it enables software, data, and entire infrastructures of companies to be used with minimal space and be accessible on multiple computers, is posing huge market opportunities. According to global research firm IDC, worldwide revenue from public IT cloud services exceeded $16 billion in 2009 and is forecast to reach $55.5 billion in 2014. As for jobs, Whitehurst has said the company will increase its workforce in China from 300 to 450 this year. Company representatives have said they will create 540 jobs and invest $109 million in expanding the corporate headquarters in Raleigh. If Red Hat grows to its CEO's expectations, state and local officials will get to count their blessings for keeping a global tech company grounded in Raleigh. And count their lucky clouds they will. On a side note to this article, cloud computing and you. A lot is being made of cloud computing. For companies such as Red Hat, it means business opportunities. For you, it means constant connectivity to all your information and data. What follows is an explanation from PCMag.com. Quote, whether you realize it or not, you're probably already using cloud-based services. Pretty much everyone with a computer has been. Gmail and Google Docs are two prime examples. We just don't think of those services in those terms. In essence, personal cloud computing means having every piece of data you need for every aspect of your life at your fingertips and ready for use. Data must be mobile, transferable, and instantly accessible. The key is enabling the portable and interactive view is the ability to sync up your data among your devices, as well as access to shared data. Shared data is the data we access online in any number of places, such as social networks, banks, blogs, newspapers, paid communities, etc. End quote. And that's all for this sidebar. Still on the front page, bottom of the fold. Corporate Ed Picks Up After Swoon at Duke by Jason DeBrun from Durham. After suffering through 2 years of corporations cutting back on training, leaders of Duke University's corporate education unit says companies are coming back as reflected in a rebound in revenue. For the year ended June 30, 2008, Duke Corporate Education reported $81 million in revenue, according to its Form 990 IRS tax form. In the next year, that figure was down to $47 million and to $29 million in 2010. Duke CE Chief Executive Officer Mike Canning says there was an additional $10 million in revenue in 2010 through a partnership with the London School of Economics and Political Science. He said it didn't have to be reported on the 990 form. Now, with the corporations emerging from the recession and chalking up profits, so is Duke CE. For the year ended June 30th, Canning estimates Duke CE will post $50 million in revenue, or an $11 million increase over its total figure last year. Quoting Canning, after 8 years of double-digit growth, we had 2 years of decline. Then this year we saw a real resurgence with a 30% uptick in revenue. End quote. As companies continue to climb out of the recession, that curve could continue upward, says Lindsay Ryan, author of Corporate Education, A Practical Guide to Effective Corporate Learning. From 2003 to 2020, due to an aging population, 70 million people will exit the U.S. workforce and be replaced by 40 million new workers, according to data provided by Ryan. Quote, this has a huge impact on workforce productivity and gross domestic product, Ryan says, adding that companies need to do a better job of developing employees, end quote. About two-thirds of Duke CE growth this year came from clients who had cut corporate education budgets in 2009. Quoting Canning again, one of the things we did during the downturn was to stay close to clients, whether or not they had the budget to work with us. And that paid big benefits because we didn't lose any clients. When business bounced back, we had a real resurgence from our previous clients, end quote. Although Duke CE files as its own entity, it has strong connections to Duke University. Executive Vice President Talman Trask, Provost Peter Lang, and Fuqua School of Business Dean Blair Shepherd had the top three base salaries from Duke CE in 2010 at $516,172, $488,664, and $475,342, respectively, according to the 990 tax report. That does not mean that corporate education is just an extension of the university classroom. Duke CE has a staff of 140, but uses a network of contractors when putting together a program for a client. Only about 5 to 10% of the educators are professors at Duke University. Others are recruited from around the world, Canning says. Programs are designed specifically for clients, instead of an open enrollment type setting in which a professor offers a class that students sign up for. A program might include tours of a harbor for executives of a shipping company, for example, or show how patients in developing countries use medical devices. Quoting Canning, we have companies that want to develop in new markets and develop global leaders. We run more immersive experiences in those markets where it's a combination of business and leadership development. End quote. Mixed in the overall recovery of Duke CE has been a focus on international programs, Canning continues. Before the downturn, Duke CE did about 50% of its programs in North Carolina and about 40% in Europe and the rest sprinkled around the globe. Now the percentage of programs in North America is down to about 40%, while clients based in Europe is up 45%. Our business in North America is growing, but not as rapidly as the other territories, and we expect this trend to continue. In contrast to corporate education programs are those for members of corporate boards, which never experienced a downturn, says Henry V. Stover, Director of Marketing at the National Association of Corporate Directors. He says, the role of directors has always been incredibly important, and strong boards translate to strong companies, he says. Even if companies cut back on their executive education, they keep budgets flush for directors. Next up, Avoiding the Cliff, Big Pharma Braces for Loss of Patents, by Monica Chin. From Durham. While Big Pharma heads down the gauntlet of losing more than $50 billion in sales from blockbuster drugs going generic in the next couple of years, the so-called patent cliff could be leading to opportunities for clinical stage companies in the triangle. Case in point, Pfizer Incorporated's rumored acquisition of Icogen this week, which sent the Durham-based company stock soaring by 196% to a 52-week high of $7.10. New York-based Pfizer will be the first big pharma to lose exclusivity on a blockbuster drug this year in what the industry has taken to calling the patent cliff. Lipitor, the cholesterol drug that has been one of the best-selling drugs in the U.S., is slated to go generic in November, resulting in the loss of $5.3 billion in U.S. sales alone, about 18% of Pfizer's U.S. revenue. Pfizer has been trying to stave off the patent loss on Lipitor by cutting a deal with Ranbaxy Laboratories, an Indian generics maker, and suing other generic companies to try to delay their production of the drug. On another front, industry experts say Pfizer and other major pharma companies are taking a shotgun approach with licensing, partnerships, and acquisitions of clinical stage companies like Icogen to cast a wide net of drug development potential. At the BIO International Convention in Washington, D.C. this week, licensing and partnership talks were in full swing, according to Vipin Gang, the CEO of Durham-based TransZyme Incorporated. There is a very robust deal-making environment out there, Garg says during a phone interview from Washington. Everybody is looking for new ideas to bring more products to their portfolio to continue their sales growth, end quote. Pfizer isn't the only large pharma to seed small pharma with development dollars. Global Data, which tracks pharmaceutical licensing and M&A deals on a monthly basis, tallied $42.2 billion in deals worldwide in May, up from $14.9 billion in April. Other trends in the industry, a tough regulatory environment and challenges with fundraising and IPOs, are feeding into such deals. The average number of approved drugs fell from an average of 36 annually in 1996 to 2004 to 21 on average in 2005 to 2010, according to Ernst & Young's 2011 Beyond Borders Global Biotechnology Report. Capital raised in initial public offerings fell from $5.9 billion from 2005 to 2007 to $2.3 billion from 2008 to 2010. As a result, triangle companies that traditionally have looked to venture funding or initial public offering to get the tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars to take a drug to market can also see additional opportunities in large pharma partnerships. Larry Robbins, a capital markets attorney with Raleigh law firm Weirich Robbins, says triangle companies also get favorable attention because of their connections with local universities and medical schools. Quote, the drug companies know not all of these companies will make it through the FDA, but they think that if we're smart about it, we'll get access to globally recognized scientists at premier institutions, Robbins says. And we're doing that at a fraction of the cost, he says. Robbins states the Icagen deal more likely could be a tuck-in acquisition by Pfizer to prevent the company's clinical pipeline and intellectual property from being acquired by a competitor. Since Pfizer began its partnership with Icagen in 2007, Pfizer has seeded Icagen with $31 million, and the partnership could yield Icagen $1 billion from various milestone and royalty payments. Pfizer is also providing Icagen with about $5 million to start Phase 2 trials for its main drug candidate for pain and epilepsy this year. The company, which has cloned more than 300 human ion channel genes, what the company says is most of the entire ion channel genome, Icagen has also about 250,000 small molecules in its intellectual property portfolio. On the flip side, companies that have not been able to raise additional money from partnerships, an IPO, or investors might become acquisition targets by Big Pharma. Quote, "These companies are going to raise capital," says Rob Tyler, a securities attorney with Poynter Sproul in Raleigh. He continues, "They're either going to have to do that through the private equity, venture capitalist, strategic investors, or they have to do it through public markets. If they're not able to raise sufficient capital, they'll probably be acquisition targets." Garg, who led TransZyme through a $51.4 million IPO in April, says large pharma is most likely interested in the latter stage companies, and that for those companies, there are more opportunities farther along the clinical trials process as well. It opens up many different opportunities, not just licensing, but also as we continue to take the risk out of the products, there will be many potential options for us to entertain, he says. Everybody is looking for revenue as quickly as possible. Getting a drug approved in 2012 is better than 2013 and is better than 2014. Further inside, retired UNC professor loses email in brouhaha. By Jason DeBrun from Chapel Hill. The expulsion of a retired professor from the UNC Chapel Hill email network has set off sparks of dissent, with free speech advocates saying the administration bowed to complaints from an outside heckler. Professor Emeritus Elliot Kramer retired in 1994, but continued an affiliation with the university. He used his official UNCCH email account for personal emails, including for the Friends of Orange County Animal Shelter, or FOCAS, which has no affiliation with UNC. He also created a FOCAS@UNC.edu email alias. Last year, New York resident Joseph Villarosa asked about making a donation to Focus, but wanted to know the group's affiliation with UNC because of the email alias. He inquired whether part of his donation would go to the university, according to emails. Kramer explained that it would not, but Villarosa accused Kramer of improperly using the university email account. Kramer and Villarosa, who had no prior association with UNC, exchanged emails of increasing intensity, and Villarosa contacted UNC leadership, including Chancellor Holden Thorpe, demanding an apology from Kramer and that Thorpe expel the professor from the network. For 5 months, the university tried to, quote, steer a neutral course and leave Dr. Kramer and Mr. Villarosa to their personal feud, end quote, but decided to take action after Kramer, after hours and hours of senior administrative time were diverted to a cascade of email correspondence from both individuals, according to a letter from Leslie Chambers Strom, UNCCH General Counsel. University leaders say they are following provisions set out in the personal use policy, especially since Kramer retired more than 15 years prior, but the move has the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, up in arms. The university initially defended Kramer, but then acquiesced to Villarosa only because he created such a hubbub, FIRE contends. Once the university has established a set of rules, it has a precedent, said Will Creeley, Director of Legal and Public Advocacy for FIRE. Professors expect that when they retire, the promise of network access will be honored. Now that UNC has revoked the access it promised Kramer, it has set an equally bad precedent, end quote. Others claim to have problems with Villarosa as well. Susan Barrett with the North Carolina Shelter Rescue Incorporated said she is under a, quote, full throttle attack, end quote, by Villarosa and has filed a no-contact order because of his alleged harassment. Fire sent a letter to Thorpe saying it is, quote, concerned about the threat to freedom of expression, end quote, because the university revoked Kramer's network access. Says Greeley, you can't change the rules in middle of the game. Just because one angry man was persistent enough, all you have to do is send them enough emails and they will get annoyed and they won't ignore you. The university seems to be talking out of both sides of its mouth, end quote. To university leaders, this is not a First Amendment issue. The dispute elevated to a level that distracted others at UNCCH and distracted them from their responsibilities. Quote, the university's decision to disable Dr. Kramer's network privileges was not a response to the content or viewpoint of Dr. Kramer's speech, but a reasonable response to the actual and significant disruption experienced by the university as a result of Dr. Kramer's use of a university resource, end quote, said Strom. At its core, Kramer says he is confused as to how this issue has blown up so large. He says, I have not a clue why Villarosa started this fight with me, pointing out that Focus is a tiny organization that typically receives less than $500 in donations annually. Contacted by email, Villarosa declined to comment. Kramer says he has nothing against Thorpe and would like for the whole situation to go away so he can continue his work of publishing research articles. Still, he does not want it to simply back down. I don't want to hurt the university, but to me, it's a matter of principle, he says. And now, Triangle Brains, A Core of Work, by Monica Chin, from Durham. Triangle scientists are having a significant say in the future of data management and the format by which new drug applications will be submitted to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Four executives with the Triangle-based companies and organizations are on the board of directors of CDISC, short for Clinical Data Interchange Standards Consortium, an international organization of drug industry and academic leaders advising the FDA on setting up clinical trial repository, otherwise known as the JANUS Project, an electronic standardized database of drug applications. The organization was founded in 1997 and now has more than 300 member companies and organizations. By 2013, the Austin, Texas-based organization hopes to submit a new set of rules for JANUS. Local executives at the forefront of the JANUS Project are Ed Helton, Associate Director of Clinical Trials Programs for the National Institute of Health, National Cancer Center Institute, the past chair of CDISC, Frank Rockhold, Senior Vice President of Drug Development Sciences at GlaxoSmithKline, current chair, Paula Brown Stafford, President of Clinical Development at Quintiles Transnational Corporation, the chair-elect, and Lauren Shinneberry, Senior Project Manager of Business Solutions with Raleigh-based PRA International, is a board member. CDISC and the JANUS Project will be key to accelerating the pipeline of approved drugs. The FDA has in recent years, slowed the approval process. In 2010, 21 new drugs were approved. That was down from 25 in 2009 and 24 in 2008. Part of the delay was due to the FDA's closer scrutiny of drug applications after well-publicized safety issues in blockbuster drugs like GSK's Avandia. But the case also could be made that drug approval delays have resulted from the amount of time needed to translate different sets of data. Quote, the FDA, in reviewing the applications for a new drug, takes a very lengthy process, Brown Stafford says. If a reviewer can use tools that they develop in reviewing a prior drug and use the same analysis, it would help them if the data looks similar. They don't have to completely recreate the analysis, end quote. Having similar data sets would also reduce problems overlooked in drug safety and provide a foundation of institutional knowledge for companies, and that would boost efficiency. Quoting Helton, it will let us have the ability to know historically not only what we did, but why we did it. It will give us a decision support system. We'll have standard rules of engagement. End quote. CDISC has come closer to getting at the root of the problem in recent years by developing data standards targeting different steps in the clinical research data chain, from data collection covered by CDASH through regulatory reporting covered by SDTM, or Study Data Tabulation Module. Janus will consolidate the different standards at the Data Warehouse Core with the FDA. The organization also is expanding standards to cover different research areas, such as cardiovascular and oncology. Quote, "These projects provide a deeper level of clinical richness to our standards," says Braun Keisler, CDISC Vice President of Strategic Initiatives. He continues, "There's a need for standards in any industry. Without standards, you're duplicating effort," Brown Stafford says. Next up, counties bite budget bullets, avoiding increasing taxes, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. County managers in Orange, Durham, and Wake did more with less this budget season, guiding new spending plans to approval that held the line on property tax increases. Two of the three counties, Wake and Durham, were forced to trim their payrolls by 15 positions and 20 positions, respectively, as they reallocated money to pay for higher priority needs. Orange, by contrast, added workers in solid waste management, libraries, and emergency services. What happened in the Triangle pretty much mirrors what's happening across the state as county governments scrambled the week of June 27 to put finishing touches on new 2011-2012 spending plans. Enough information has come into the Raleigh-based North Carolina Association of County Commissioners to draw a few early conclusions. As in the three-county Triangle region, managers elsewhere pulled out the stops to hold the line on property taxes. In one 18-county survey that includes counties from Forsyth in the Piedmont to Pamlico on the coast, 12 counties, or 66%, avoided any tax increases. One, Guilford, raised taxes by 4.5% to meet debt service payments, while four others actually cut taxes. Quote, "They did everything they could to hold off," says Association spokesman Todd McGee. "What we're seeing is a continuation of the last couple of years. Counties are still dealing with the effects of the recession," end quote. Another early conclusion from the partial data is that the damage done by cuts in state appropriations to counties didn't live up to the early speculation. The worst, McGee says, doesn't appear to have happened. Wake County's $952 million 2011-2012 budget will actually spend $800,000 more than in 2010-2011, says County Manager David Cook. But it still represents a belt-tightening budget if compared to the $984 million spending plan the county had back in 2008. He says, "We've basically taken $30 million out of the equation since then. I think I felt more shocked dealing with this 3 years ago than I did this year. This year was just a continuation of the shock." End quote. Wake's challenge this year was to fully fund public schools while paying for such items as a county jail expansion and mental health facilities, Cook says. All were accomplished. In Orange County, the new $178 million general fund spending plan is actually $2.8 million, or 1.7% higher than last year's budget. Budget Director Paul Lawton says the county did most of its heavy cutting last year, eliminating 14 positions from the payroll. This time around, after finding extra dollars, managers decided to add 13.5 employee slots, 10 of them in emergency medical services. Durham, while cutting 20 slots from its payroll, also set aside funds to add 11 workers over the next year, if possible. While Wake and Orange were able to pull even slight spending increases in their new budgets, many of the other county governments included in the County Commission Association survey weren't so fortunate. Across the state, spending cuts appear to have ranged from 2.5% to around 4%. Of the 10 counties reporting on their specific spending actions, 7 said overall spending was down, while only 3 reported that it had increased. And now a story about banks. Fifth Third, others nibbling as bank serves up branches, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. A number of regional and state banks are expected to kick the tires on a potential deal to acquire five triangle branches of Gateway Bank put on the block by Virginia-based Hampton Roads Bank shares. Still battling a problem real estate loan portfolio, Hampton Roads, which does business here under the Gateway name, says it's taking the step to cut costs. It's a pullback from what could have been one of Virginia Bank's most lucrative markets, but for those eyeing the deal, it offers a ready-made opportunity to enter the triangle or enhance a presence here. Among the banks exposed to the deal include Cincinnati, Ohio-based Fifth Third, which already has five Wake County offices and is known to have the market on its list of expansion targets. Fifth Third spokeswoman Stephanie Honan declined to comment on what she described as market speculation. Closer to home, others with a potential interest in looking at the deal are Thomasville-based Bank of North Carolina, which has a Raleigh office, and Charlotte-based Park Sterling, which raised $150 million last year as part of a plan to buy up struggling bank properties. The Hampton Gateway branches up for sale include two in Raleigh and one each in Cary, Wake Forest, and Chapel Hill, along with the office's nearly $189 million in deposits. A sixth office in Wilmington is also on the market. Hampton Roads has the option of selling the offices one at a time or bundling the locations into a single package, Triangle plus Wilmington. Originally opened by Gateway Bank during a period of rapid growth back in the mid-2000s, Hampton acquired Gateway in late 2008. The offices just don't figure into Virginia Bank's new preoccupation with its own backyard of Tidewater, Virginia, as it attempts to cut its losses and work through problem real estate loans, says Ken Inkley, chief economic strategist and banking analyst for Richmond-based Capital Securities Management. Quote, Raleigh-Durham is a very good market, but it is outside their key focus for now, he says. In more favorable conditions, the Triangle stable of community banks would have been expected to eye possible locations in the Hampton Gateway portfolio. Many, however, continue to stress capital preservation. Recently asked if his investment group, Piedmont Community Bank Holdings, was interested in the Gateway branches, Raleigh banker Scott Custer said the group's focus continues to be completing its acquisition of Cary-based Crescent State Bank. Troy-based First Bank Corp, which acquired Wilmington-based Cooperative Bank in 2009, and the Bank of Asheville in 2011, both in government-assisted transactions, could use the Hampton branch offering to fill in its eastern footprint. Quote, I know they're always looking at deals, says analysis Will Curtis, who covers First Bank for Sandler O'Neill and Partners. Curtis adds, however, that he has no specific knowledge that First Bank has even looked at the Hampton branch deal. And now, forget Spanish and French, students are picking Asian languages. Enrollment in Arabic and Mandarin up at both UNC and NCSU, chosen as cool languages. This is the Campus Corner by Olivia Barrow. From Raleigh, more students are taking the Asian route to fulfilling their foreign language requirements at two of the Triangle's three research universities. Enrollment in Arabic has doubled at UNC Chapel Hill and tripled at NC State University over the past 5 years, and enrollment in Mandarin has increased at both schools during the same period. Duke University has not experienced any significant trend in its Asian languages. Quote, college students are really adventurous, says Jan Beersley, chair of the UNC Department of Asian Studies. They're willing to try something new, end quote. For UNC sophomore Georgia Walker, the cool factor played a role in her decision to study Arabic, but future career goals were also a factor. Walker says, my brother took Chinese and my parents were really proud of him, so I was like, I want to take a cool language. If you're interested in working for the government like me, it helps in getting a job. NC State Chancellor Randy Woodson says the trend reflects students' desire to be successful in the global market. Culturally, it's clear that the U.S. will be working hard to be better partners culturally with the Middle East in the future, he says. Although the major growth in international business is seen in Brazil, Russia, India, and China, Arabic still wins out as the fastest growing language because of the number of news headlines appearing daily about Arabic-speaking countries, Bardsley says. Continuing his quote, all in all, it really becomes important that the people like the culture they're studying because the culture and the language go together so much, she says. At UNC, most majors require only that students take 3 semesters of one language. Asian languages, including Arabic, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Hindi, have experienced an overall upswing despite the fact that studies show it takes about 8 years of concerted study to become proficient in them, Beardsley says. To keep students in the classes past the 3rd semester, which only scratches the surface for languages that have different writing systems from English, they have to be interested in the culture, Bardsley says. Nariman Hinkle, a sophomore at UNC, says her family heritage was a big part of her decision to study Arabic. I'm Egyptian, she says. I'm planning to study abroad in the spring at the American University in Cairo, so I will go further with it. Languages are popular combination majors or minors at both universities, but they're not just popular with business majors. Quote, a lot of our combination majors are international studies, political science, or history, says Ruth Goss, head of the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures at NCSU. Professors at NCSU and UNC play a big part in helping students understand foreign cultures by offering enrichments outside of class and independent of the university, including conversations with native speakers and traditional cultural dinners at a professor's home. Quote, it's the instructors here who feel that their students need outside interest in the culture and encourage it in various ways, Gross says. And now, state's Medicaid performance can't be tracked, says audit. Leaders of the Department of Health and Human Services differ with auditors over indicators used to track programs administration. This article is written by Jason DeBrun, and it's from Raleigh. The state office that oversees Medicaid spending does not adequately chart its performance, making it impossible to determine how it performs, according to a state audit. The Division of Medical Assistance operates under the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services and oversees the more than $10 billion in annual Medicaid reimbursements to health care providers. State Auditor Beth A. Wood released a report that shows the DMA has limited transparency because it does not use the proper key indicators to evaluate performance. This makes it difficult or impossible for legislatures or the public to determine how well DMA carries out its duties, the audit found. Quoting, as a result, the decision makers may lack information necessary for determining whether the division is achieving the goals for which state appropriations were allocated to it, according to the audit. Key agency indicators, as established in 2008 by the Office of State Budget Management, quote, provide a big picture gauge of an agency, the work it values, and the progress it will make over the course of the next few years, end quote. Specifically to the division, they include Medicaid enrollment changes, North Carolina Health Choice, which offers free or reduced price comprehensive health care for children, enrollment changes, and percentage of NCHC eligibles linked to a Carolina Community North Carolina Primary Care Physician, a public-private partnership that links health care providers with those in need of health care. DHHS Secretary Lanier Kanzler contends the audit focused on the wrong measures. The key indicators referenced in the audit were developed in 2007 and 2010, but after that, DMA worked with a different set of measures it says more accurately defines success. The division reported those to the Office of State Budget and Management. The state audit acknowledges the new measures but points out that the original key indicators were still posted on the OSBM website, leaving confusion for anyone wanting to track DMA and providing limited operational transparency of the agency. The division needs to take the analysis and recommendations to heart, says State Representative Nelson Dollar, a Wake County Republican who chairs the House Health and Human Services Committee. He continues, they need to work on the issues that have been identified. Although the audit points to an apparent lack of transparency at DMA, Dollar argues that taxpayers should be encouraged by the audit. Quote, it should say that we are working hard to ensure accountability in state government and to make methods by which we are delivering the services the best they possibly can be, he says. In an emailed statement after the audit was released, DHHS again points to the new set of 39 performance indicators, which it calls dashboards, that more adequately capture the complexities of what is, in essence, a $10 billion insurance operation serving 1.4 million North Carolinians. State auditors acknowledge that better measures might exist, but if the agency or OSBM do not clearly list those, and the previously decided indicators are still advertised, then it would lead the public to use those measures to benchmark the agency. Auditors added that the OSBM should enforce its requirements of agencies to keep information updated and that if changes are made, they should be clearly posted so that decision makers, legislatures, and taxpayers can better understand an agency's actions and how it spends tax money. Next up, SBA dumps popular fast cash loan pool. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. A fast cash lending program that has been one of the most popular offerings of the U.S. Small Business Administration in North Carolina has been scrapped, apparently because of concerns over rising defaults. Set up a decade ago as a pilot program, SBA's Community Express offered quick micro-infusions, generally ranging from $5,000 to $50,000, into cash-starved women and minority-owned companies. Loans up to $25,000 often didn't require any collateral. Among North Carolina's top Community Express loan writers was Walnut, California-based lender Superior Financial Group, which perennially has vied with Winston-Salem-based BB&T as the state's top SBA lender, based on number of loans made, not volume. In the 8 months between October 2010 and May 2011, for example, Superior made 128 loans valued at $1.37 million, second only to BB&T's 157 loans for $18 million. Nationally, between 2006 and 2009, Superior was SBA's 18th busiest lender. SBA North Carolina District Office spokesman Mike Hernandez in the Charlotte confirms that Community Express was allowed to sunset on April 30th, but he did not provide a reason. He said SBA has kicked off two additional programs to serve the same sort of business borrowers. Tamara DeClercq, Superior's Vice President of Operations, says SBA pulled the plug over asset quality concerns. Quote, they were alarmed the default rate was rising, end quote. It's a contention she takes issue with. However, SBA picks up more than 80% of the costs when a Community Express loan goes bad. DeClercq says the entire Community Express program only represented 0.12% of SBA's subsidies. Moreover, she adds, Superior's charge-offs for bad loans was 5.3% of the group's gross loans between 2006 and 2009, a few points higher than the 4.2% posted by SunTrust, but bettering the 7% put up by Pittsburgh-based PNC Bank. Quote, it's also a misnomer that the size of the loans we made didn't really matter, she says. We provided quick access to working capital, and a lot of these businesses needed the cash, end quote. The SBA program set to replace Community Express are currently getting off the ground. One dubbed Small Loan Advantage with loan cap of $350,000 will be run by banks, which generally shy away from making microloans. The second is called Community Advantage, which will go through community development organizations and microlenders, nonprofit, to make capital available to borrowers. Raleigh's Steve Marinari, who's Diamond Financial Structures, SBA Loans, says at the end of the day he isn't surprised to see the Quick Cash Community Express program go by the board. Lack of collateral standards, he says, raises many warning flags. Quote, I believed it was a recipe for disaster, he says. Moreover, Marinieri adds, many of the small cash loans made by the program went to companies with much deeper capital needs, and putting $35,000 on a $150,000 problem just doesn't make any sense, he says. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Tapping the Power of Collective Giving. A group of people in Durham who moved past homelessness with the help of Housing for New Hope and wanted to give back to the group formed an unofficial alumni association that took on the task of looking for homeless people under bridges and on the streets and trying to connect them with the nonprofit and its services. With a small grant from Next Generation of African American Philanthropists, or NGAAP, a giving circle housed at the Triangle Community Foundation, the alumni group visited members of North Carolina's congressional delegation in Washington, D.C., to talk about policy changes to better address the problem of homelessness. Formed in 2003, NGAAP is part of a Raleigh-based national organization known as the Community Investment Network, or CIN, that works to boost the work of giving circles in which African Americans and other communities of color pool their charitable dollars and make grants to community groups that often are off the radar of institutional funders. CIN, formed in 2005 by consultant Daryl Lester and his wife Dion, who served as an administrator of the Raleigh-based network, has hired its first full-time executive director and aims to continue to help develop and support giving circles throughout the United States, particularly the South. Quote, the vision for the Community Investment Network was to demystify what philanthropy is, to help folks be more strategic with how they use their time, talent, and treasure, says Daryl Lester, a former program officer at the Triangle Community Foundation, who left the organization in 2001 and, with his wife, formed Hindsight Consulting. Through the network, he says, people could be more civically engaged with a space to provide more education for the ordinary working-class donors. In addition to focusing on community-based philanthropy, Hindsight Consulting initially consulted with the Ford Foundation to encourage foundations to invest in the South. That effort, Lester says, found there was giving outside of foundations that needed to be more strategic and focus on addressing issues of race and equity in the South. Hindsight Consulting has assisted in the formation of 11 giving circles with 175 members that are part of the Community Investment Network. Those giving circles include 5 in the Triangle, are housed at their local community foundations, and collectively make grants totaling about $50,000 a year. The network provides technical support for giving circles and convenes members to talk about topics like fund development and grant making. Chad U. Jones, a former program officer at the Marguerite Casey Foundation in Seattle, joined the network in May as its Denver, Colorado-based executive director. Lester, who says giving circles help community foundations better understand community-based giving, sees ongoing challenges for giving circles. Those include avoiding the pitfall of competing for donations with the community groups they support, and helping marginalized communities make the psychological transition from being the beneficiaries of philanthropy to becoming donors. Lester says it takes a while to move people from the demand side of giving to the supply side. And now the legal focus from Jim Verdonik. Newbie grads are like shipped bikes, assembly required. Any veteran business knows the polish must be buffed to begin grooming new workers. Recent college graduations remind us that another crop of newbies is entering the business world, at least the few who will find jobs. Are you prepared? Are the newbies prepared? What kind of educations have your new workers received? Small things point to disconnects between education and reality. An outline for my daughter's college American history course asked, what were the causes for American intervention into World War II? I suggested my daughter call her grandfather, a World War II vet, to ask why he intervened in World War II, but changed my mind. He's 92 and might not survive to 93, and if he knew his granddaughter was taught he intervened in World War II, that raised the question, can your business survive workers being taught that America intervened in World War II? That specific question probably won't come up in your business, but it raises questions about what other disconnects with reality our schools produce. What should you do to educate your next generation of employees about reality? In my legal business, letting young lawyers loose with clients without supervision is a recipe for disaster. It takes at least 5 years for law school graduates to unlearn unrealistic theories law schools teach. There's an art to teaching a smart graduate how to identify and solve client problems rather than analyze theoretical legal arguments. So it is with all businesses. We receive highly educated graduates each year and face the task of helping them become productive, problem-solving workers. How well is your business doing that? Let's talk about some basic approaches. Realize that recent graduates are like the bicycle you buy on the internet for Christmas. The bike isn't shipped pre-assembled. You've got some work to do before it becomes functional. Have you evaluated your training program's effectiveness lately? You should. Many training programs were developed for a prior generation and a very different work environment. How reality-based is your training program? Next, any training program should assume recent graduates know nothing useful. Also, what your new workers think they know is more dangerous than what they know they don't know. Also, the military, which has trained millions of recruits, disabuses each generation fairly early in boot camp that they know anything. Learn from that. Understand that this approach will probably initially shock and demoralize workers taught for two decades how wonderful they are. Don't panic. It's part of the plan to rebuild from scratch. Next, teaching young workers theory is useful to develop plans, but both theories and plans must change when they confront reality. Also, remind workers that listening to customers, co-workers, and vendors is a better path to reality than talking. Eyes and ears are more important than mouths, even for lawyers. And finally, provide opportunities for young workers to fail in ways that cause only small harm. Did you ever read about a troubled business and ask yourself, what were they thinking when they decided to do that? They were probably thinking what they were taught in school, and no one took the time to unlearn them. We'd like to say congratulations to Calvin Ferguson, a rising senior at Clayton High School, who performed at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts on June 26th. The 17-year-old tenor was among 150 high school students from across the country selected to perform as part of Music Education Week in Washington, D.C. Take that, Scotty. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the TBJ will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.